Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event, and I'd like to welcome our live audience here in San Francisco and our radio and online audiences. It's my great pleasure to introduce Susan Krieger, Professor Susan Krieger at Stanford, the author of Come, Let Me Guide You. Susan spoke here 4 years ago on her book, the most articulate expression of having to learn to deal with not being able to see clearly anymore. And also, such a wonderful expression of the relationship she has with her guide dogs. And now, the guide dog that was here the first time is retired now, and she has a new guide dog. And so she has a new book about the process of switching guide dogs and the whole process of how it's developed. And it's just wonderful to have you back, Susan.
Thank you, George. I'll take a moment here and settle my two guide dogs. All right. Let's see. One more motion. Okay. Well, please excuse that delay. I'm Susan Krieger, and at my feet on my right is my retired guide, Tila, who graces the cover of the book, Come, Let Me Guide You. On my left is my current active guide, Fresco, who appears in the last chapter. Now I'm going to settle Fresco.
Fresco?
Good. They're very sensitive dogs, so if I move or there's a slight change in situation, they both get up and seem to want to know if I would like to be taken somewhere. But I think they're settled well for the evening. Well, I am going to tell you some about myself, some highlights from the new book, Come, Let Me Guide You, A Life Shared with a Guide Dog, some of its basic themes. Then we're going to have a reading of excerpts by the audiobook narrator, Ann Richardson, who's here with us this evening. And I'll be interested after that in any questions you may have or any sharing of similar experiences. I am a sociologist and a writer. I teach in the program in Feminist, Gender, and Sexuality Studies at Stanford. And I am unusual for a sociologist in that I draw on my first-person experiences in order to develop broader insights. I write in a very intimate style, and Come Let Me Guide You, A Life Shared with a Guide Dog, is more intimate in many ways than any of the work I've done before. It covers the entire 10-year span of my working life with my guide dog, Tila, and goes on to discuss other relationships in my life during that time that have been enriched and supported by our bond, and concludes with the introduction of Fresco, a new guide dog, into our joint life. The book is full of many interesting person-dog stories, and I hope that it may interest some of you. It was certainly a delight for me to write. But I would mention at the start that in addition to the many interesting stories, there are two basic themes. And one is the importance of external support for personal identity. And a second theme is that the book calls attention to the many nuances of intimate communication, of intimate conversations between self and other and within the self that help make personal identity possible, and indeed to help sustain a positive sense of self. I have an eye condition called birdshot retinochoroidopathy, which is a rare autoimmune eye disease that I've had for nearly 20 years. It started as inflammation of my choroid and retina and produced scarring as a result, and the result of this is that I have many blind areas in my central vision and in my peripheral vision, areas in which I plainly do not see. The residual vision that I have is blurry, lacks detail, lack normal color vision, lack depth perception. I tend to see pieces of things and see them slowly. And this poses obstacles to mobility because I'll be walking down the street and I can easily bump into a scaffolding or a parked car or step into a pothole, miss a curb, miss a staircase. And for this type of impairment, it has been especially valuable to me to have the assistance of a guide dog. I received the gift of Tila from Guide Dogs for the Blind in 2003, And the book then covers that entire span from 2003 to 2013. I would like to mention to you that, you know, I'm unusual for a sociologist and even for a writer, I think, in that in this book, I actually start with the end rather than the beginning. I start with a chapter called An Older Guide Dog, rather than starting as I might have done with when I first got Tila, though I go on to discuss that. But the impetus for this book was that, or for this series about Tila, was that I had been writing a book and had several chapters already drafted on this theme of intimate narrative. I called it The Art of the Intimate Narrative, and I was illustrating different stories drawn from my life that could help us to understand better what happens when we try to have intimate conversations with others and the importance of the intimate conversations within the self. I was looking for my next chapter, and Tila and I were, she was approaching retirement. I had at that point had her for 9.5 years. She was 11. She's 14 now. And I was waiting for a new guide dog, and Tila was waiting for a new guide dog to come along and relieve her of her duties. And I thought, well, that'll be my next chapter, and I'll call it A New Pair of Eyes, a new dog who will open up a new sense of adventure for me. I was waiting, and we were waiting. And then guide dog seemed not to have the appropriate dog for me for some time. So I looked down one day, and there was Tila, and I thought, well, this is the dog I have. I might as well see if there's something I can write about here. And that's how I started writing about an older guide dog, our present at that time, which was that we live in San Francisco, and I would be walking down the street with her. We'd get to mid-block, and there'd be construction on the side. She'd stop and wouldn't want to go further. She'd turn me around, walk me back to the corner we came from, cross me the street, walk down the other side, and then we could continue in our direction. Or we'd be walking down a street and we'd approach a bus stop, and I noticed she started to run. She started to bolt, and I had to run after her because she didn't want to get on a bus anymore. The buses are noisy. They have hissing air brakes in San Francisco with the many hills. We go up and down on them, and she didn't want to be jostled about. So she was communicating with me very intensely about her new sensitivities. And we'd get home, she'd want to get under a desk or a table to get away from any loud noises that were outdoors. She was having trouble with stairs, getting in and out of the car. I began to write about these experiences. And as I did so, I thought that indeed this was a very special time and that this really was a good place for me to begin a story of our life together, because my dog seemed even more communicative and even more endearing than she had earlier. And so I wrote about this time in our life. As I did so, I also was aware that when I walked the streets with Tila, I was also walking with the younger Tila, the dog I first came home with 9.5 years before. This then led to a second chapter, When She Was Young, where I suddenly found myself writing a biography of my dog. Tila was born in 2001 in Guide Dogs for the Blind, and then how she was taken by her puppy raisers up to Weaverville, where she was raised, and how in 2003 I went to Guide Dogs and lived there for a month and was trained with her. I began to write about, you know, and to think about her parents. She is, you might be able to tell by looking, though she's resting now, she's half Golden Retriever and half Lab. And as soon as I received her, I began to appreciate this duality of her personality. I always thought of her Golden Retriever self as her party girl self, the part of the dog that just wants to have a good time, happy-go-lucky dog, and her Labrador Retriever self as her more dutiful self, the self that makes her a good guide dog, good at taking commands, and good at turning to me for permission for much that she does. It seemed to me that her party girl self complemented a good deal my personality, in that I tend to be a fairly individual, maybe sometimes isolated person with a lot of worries, and I'll tend to walk down the street thinking about a problem I have and what can I do to solve it. But with this dog, I would walk down the street and she'd be going, what's interesting going on down the block there? Maybe we should go down there. Maybe there's a party going on. You know, it would be just, how can we have fun? And her spirited presence sort of converted me and made me then feel like the purpose of going out every day was to have a good time and look for something interesting going on, if only to make life happy for my dog. So through the entire 10 years, as the book displays, I had this complementarity in our relationship and this playfulness because of the temperament of the dog. You know, a guide dog does guide you around obstacles and changes in elevation and saves your life many times with problems with mobility. But there's an added aspect, which is the personality of the dog, that has complemented my own and has been very important in each case. Now, given the playful nature of the dog, as soon as I started to write about our life together, I had to present this experience of ours. Ever since I first got Tila, we have played Frisbee. And we continue to play Frisbee, and she's 14 now. This is only a problem in that we had just come back from guide dog training, and they had told us there were two things you should never do with your dog. One was to play ball, and the other to play Frisbee, because you would be out having a good time, and someone would be playing ball or Frisbee, and your dog would just go to retrieve it, and you would be in tow to retrieve it. So I always hoped that no one would watch us or catch us at it and report us. And they never did, and we never seemed to have chased other people's Frisbees, but we much enjoyed it because she's part Labrador Retriever. And if we were be out in a field or even at the beach or something, and I'd want to let her off her leash, get her exercise, one, she'd leave me and I couldn't see her and find her. And second, she'd put her head down to find anything interesting to smell, and if it was interesting, she'd think it would be even more interesting if she ingested it. But with the Frisbee, I could throw it. She got her exercise, and she always came back to me. She always came back to have me throw it to her again because she's such a retriever at heart. So this playing Frisbee became a very important part of our life together, keeping her with exercise and keeping me also playful and having a time out from the rest of the world just because I had to go take my dog and play with her. So I discussed this type of thing in addition to our normal guide work that we were doing during this time in the early part of the book. I then discuss her middle year somewhat, and I'd like to tell you one story from that section that has stayed with me. We're in the middle period. We're on an airplane, Tila and me, and a man sitting next to me turns to me, and he says, "Oh, nice dog. Yes, nice dog." He says, "I really miss my dog." He says, "I think I'd like to take my dog on a plane. When I get home, I think I'll get a little vest for him and a doctor's note." And I sat there and Now, only later, when I was off the plane, did I suddenly think to myself, why didn't you say anything? Why didn't you say to the man, you're thinking, wouldn't it be nice to take your dog on the plane? You're not thinking, wouldn't it be nice to be blind? Wouldn't it be nice to have the source of distress that causes this woman to need this dog? But I never said anything to the man, and I never say anything to people, because I think I have always wanted my connection with my dog to be a positive connection between me and other people, not something negative. But it caused me to think, and it caused me to think about how easily having a guide dog has made my blindness invisible, in a way, to other people, but also to me. And it seemed to me, and still does, that it is most important to remind myself of this fact so that I remember not to make it always invisible to myself, because I need not to forget that I need to be hugely careful when out and moving and on streets, and that I need to view myself and my life with, in a way, an extra measure of kindness, because things take me more time. There are more stumbling blocks, more frustrations, and I need to view my efforts to do things with all the aids that I have, and in spite of my blindness, I need to view those efforts with a generosity and not be harsh on myself for taking so many extra steps and taking more time and having to figure things out over and over. So I need to remember my blindness and not have it become invisible. So there's a negative to the invisibility, but also, as I wrote about it and examined it, I felt that there is definitely a positive to it, because when I'm walking down the street with Tila and then with Fresco, you know, I'm usually thinking about my dog more than about myself. I'm thinking, well, What should we do next? Is she happy? Is she hungry? Where might we play? Is she having a good time? I'm thinking about her needs more than my own, and I am not thinking, oh, poor me, I don't see. So it's got its positives and it's got its negatives, and it's very important to separate those out, or has been for me, and writing and studying and looking at the experience closely has been helpful to that end. I'd like to pause here, we're sort of mid-book, and turn the microphone over to the audiobook reader, Ann Richardson, who's going to read you a passage that illustrates some of these themes about the importance of external support for personal identity, and particularly that illustrates some of these nuances of intimate communication, of intimate conversation, in this case between me and the dog and within myself, that can help make a positive sense of self possible. Ann?
Good evening. Friends have sometimes commented that Tila is like two dogs, the obedient dog who seems calm and still, the guide dog, the Tila when she is working, and the wiggly, active, alert, high-strung dog who simply cannot get enough loving or petting, the Tila when she is off harness with them. She has been those two different dogs over all these years, never letting either one of them slide or change much in their constancy. But for me, she has always been one dog. I know what it takes for her to be obedient, and I value that and take pride in her dutiful working mentality and behaviors. At the same time, her playfulness, her alert party girl, golden retriever self, is a joy to me, and we go back and forth between the two. Had she not that lighter side, her more carefree dog energy, she would not be as good for me, I think, brightening my mood, lifting me up, making each day a new adventure, offering me a new awareness of my surroundings. It's as if she says, "You owe it to me. It can't be all work. We have to have some fun." And then we do. Sometimes when I've been playing frisbee with Tila out in a field, when I've decided we are ready to be done because she is tired or we have someplace to go and more work to do, I will plan to take the frisbee from her the next time she retrieves it. She can often sense that I'm about to do this, and she holds the frisbee firmly, grasping it resolutely in her mouth, not wanting to let it go. I give a tug, but I cannot get the frisbee out. "Give," I say to her. She rolls her eyes up at me, holding tightly to her prize. "Give," I say again, yanking it gently because I do not want to tear the frisbee by trying to take it forcibly from her teeth. I get down, squatting in front of her, face to face, nose to nose. "Time to go," I say. "No," she responds. "A while longer." "No," I say. "Give, now." I then pry open her mouth carefully, but prying nonetheless. She gradually releases the bright red disc. I take it and wave it at her, signaling that I will throw it one more time. I want to reward her for giving it to me and to indicate to her that every time she thinks I'm going to take it does not mean that I will. We enjoy a few more throws, and finally I take the frisbee, hiding my intent, and put it in my bag. Tila then goes off a few paces from me and squats and pees, as I have taught her to do after playing, because the activity stimulates her system, and we are off. As we go, I think about how much her liveliness is a source of pleasure for me. When she plays, I play. When she works, so do I. Often on our way home from doing our errands, my fun-loving dog has stopped at the entrance to a playground 2 blocks from our house. There is a tennis court within it from which many balls may stray, and a grassy field and side areas where she and I have played over the years. She halts at the entrance to this interesting place in the midst of guiding me, looks longingly in, and refuses to go on. I cannot tug her forward, cannot command her, I cannot physically make her go. I must instead have a conversation with her. I reach down and pat the top of her head and say to her, "Yes, I understand you want to go in, but we have to go home now. We'll play another time." I say this thoughtfully as I touch the furrow of her brow, and I must take my time so that she will feel listened to, heard and understood, her wishes registered. We then proceed up the hill. My dog and I, we walk, we talk, We have developed our ways. We have been safe over all these years. Before I got Tila, I was hit by a car I did not see coming while crossing a street. I was tossed up on the hood of the car, spun around, and thrown onto a sidewalk. Fortunately, I was not badly hurt, but it was a warning. You are not traveling safely. After that, I started using a white cane, and soon I wanted to get a dog. It was an extended process of applying to guide dog school, passing an interview and repeated tests, proving I was capable. And then I was given Tila, my golden girl, and I started having adventures with her. Often, especially in the early years, I took her for granted, even as she changed my life. I had to get used to being led along sidewalks and to what people would say. Are you training that dog? What a beautiful dog! What's wrong with your eyes? How long have you had her? What's her name? Why can't you tell me? Oh, how nice for you, dear, they would say. I had to get used to getting the dog food and to having fur all over the house. Fur I could not see, but I feared others would see it and think that I kept a dirty house. I had to get used to my black dress pants being covered with golden hair. Guide dog heather, they called it in the school. I had to get used to how to maneuver Tila when Hannah and I were walking together. So many things have happened to Tila and me over the years, so many significant moments. The world has opened up for me and become a more alive place. My blindness recedes as a handicap and becomes a license to travel aided. Walking with Tila, I think about her needs more often than my own, and I think about how to make my experiences into joys, small joys, because I am with her, because that is what she likes to do. It has been a long time that Tila and I have been sharing this road, the sidewalks, the country paths, the city and the desert, the beaches, the campus, the backseat of cars. It has been a long time, and I never want to forget, not one moment of it, not the specialness of having her, nor the select group to which she and I belong. I have been a person who walks with a guide dog. I have had that privilege. I have been able to not walk alone, to share the adventure, to be led by another life. In this case, that life has been more exuberant than perhaps I am, and more attuned to the smells and excitements of the world, more cautious at times, a guide into my future, a guide away from my past and from the noxious stimulants, the harsh noises, the things I might not like about the city. In our comforting of each other, our watching out for each other's safety, in that I have found respite and a home.
Thank you, Anne. Anne has recorded the whole book as an audiobook, and I greatly appreciate her reading. She makes my words sound far better than when I read them. But you can get a feeling. It was actually great fun to write about my relationship with my guide dog as a way of getting at some deeper themes and insights. So that's an excerpt from that early and mid part of the book. And I would tell you a little bit about as the book progresses. It follows me with Tila through some of my other experiences during this 10-year period. And one thing that I talk about is a section called Searching for Sight, in which I discuss my continued efforts to see, even though I see in a very limited fashion, and the fact that even though I have Tila guiding me, I still worry about stumbling, falling, losing my way, and in fact do lose my way and must recover. And I try to deal with the fact that I still value the limited amount of vision that I do have, so that I use a camera at times and take pictures when we're out places, and I have to deal with the contradictory fact of thinking about how I appear. I'm a person with a guide dog and a camera, because I'm taking pictures, because I use a strong telephoto on the camera. It magnifies the scene, so sometimes, you know, I can see things that I couldn't see with my naked eye. But then when I get it home, I can put it on my computer screen and blow it up big and often see things that I didn't even know were there to begin with. But I try to enjoy my sight, the extent that I have my sight, as well as my blindness, just like I really seem to look at having a guide dog as a prospect for adding enjoyment to my life, in addition to helping to make me safe. So I discuss some of these issues of blindness and sight in the middle section. I also discuss a time when my mother was in her last days, and Tila and I get on an airplane. We are picked up at the airport in Philadelphia by my sister and her husband with a sandwich for me and a bowl of dog food for Tila. And we go up and we visit my mother, and it was hard, but I am aware that having Tila with me just reminded me of myself, gave me a grounding in myself that helped in such time. I go on later in the book, because I am a sociologist and an academic, to discuss my whole approach to writing, this art of the intimate narrative that I do in this book, as I have previously. And I tried to talk about how writing about my relationship with my dog has added to my writing possibilities. Because, you know, sociologists don't usually write about person's relation with animals. It's usually social, person with person. But I have found that in writing about my relation with the guide dog, that it has expanded my repertoire, made me in a way sometimes more sentimental, more emotional in my writing, freed me in a way, just like the dog frees me as we walk on the street. And also it's made me more introspective in some ways, because, you know, with the dog's guiding you and you have time to think, and you think about yourself and you think about yourself in relation to the other, it's a very encouraging of a relational way of reflecting. So I discuss this in a chapter about the writing. I have a chapter about teaching, too, because during this entire 10-year span, Tila lay under a seminar table, in particular in one class I discuss, a course on women and disabilities that I taught at Stanford during the time. And I began to teach it soon after I became seriously blind, and I knew nothing about the subject. I was about 3 months in advance of the students, since I picked the books and then they read them. And I discussed how over the 10-year period, my learning increased. And the chapter has many accounts from readings that we do in the course by women with disabilities, so that the reader of this book gets a sense of other women's experiences of disabilities and the disability studies field in general, to provide a context for my own personal experiences that run throughout. And in conclusion, I finally do have this chapter called A New Pair of Eyes to round out my story of the 10-year time, because during the time I was still writing, guide dogs did find an appropriate dog for me and Tila was able to retire. In A New Pair of Eyes, I discuss that initial period when I first got the new boy, Fresco. I tried him out and I was overjoyed because he had a swift pace, a fast-paced dog, and Tila's a fast-paced dog, and I like to walk fast. Somehow, it gives that sense of freedom, you know, and if you get a slow dog, you will never be able to walk fast. They have their own pace, so I was glad he had a fast-paced, smooth, gliding motion to his gait. It really matters how they walk, you know, because you're going to walk that way. And so I was happy. I looked down. I had a golden glow by my side, just like she had been a golden glow. It felt like I was coming home, a new boy. Then new boy comes home, and the real work of the transition started to take place, which I describe. Now, I had training with him at my home in San Francisco, whereas Tila, I was on the guide dog campus, and the trainer came to the house. We started our training. He's an excellent guide. I mean, she would be at the corners, maybe I'll miss the curb, maybe there's something interesting down the block. He gets to a curb, puts on the brakes. It's like we're in the army. It was shocking. You know, I was so used to the more wayward spirit of her. So we're doing the training. He's doing very well. I take out the Frisbee and I say very soon afterwards, throw it to him. And there I discovered that my new boy had no retriever instinct. For 10 years, I threw a Frisbee to a dog as a chief form of escaping from the world, of having delight, getting the dog exercise, getting me to relax in the outdoors. I threw it to him. He'd watch me throw, and he'd watch the arm. I could tell. And he'd want to please me, just like when he's taking orders when he guides, and he'd sail off after the air with the Frisbee left, and he'd run right past it, put his nose down, and smell the ground. And I did that over and over, and I really wanted him to retrieve. The trainer tried to help me train him by putting pieces of food on the Frisbee so that maybe when he went past it, he'd stop, pick it up, and bring it back to me. He picked up the piece of food and brought it back to me and came for bed. We went to the beach, Tila and Fresco and I threw the Frisbee to Tila, and I said, "Watch, see how happy she is. She returns the Frisbee." No, he would chase her. but he wanted to smell. Now, this may seem odd. A woman is given a guide dog because she is blind and needs assistance, and all she cares about is whether the dog will play Frisbee. I really did care. I took for granted he was a good guide, but it was so important to me. It was a blow that he wouldn't do it. And I was sad every day of my training for those 2 weeks, and almost in tears, actually in tears some days, because he wasn't her. And I think that what was going on to some extent was, for 10 years, I had this one dog, and then you turn over, and the next day, you have another one. It's a different personality. It does different things. You're going to have to work out a whole new way of being, and hadn't yet done that, and I missed her. And it took the form of, but he doesn't play Frisbee. He doesn't retrieve. Now, it took me a while, and the chapter is in part a story of my adjustment to the new personality of my dog. You know, I had to learn that, you know, he has a very big nose. He has many olfactory sensors in his nose, and the world of smell is so interesting to him that I had to learn that he takes as much satisfaction from smelling the ground and the air and just following it as she does from following an object thrown through the air. So it took a while for me to learn his pleasures, because I really seem to have wanted to share the pleasures of my guide dog very, very much. And that took a while for my first love of a guide dog to become also a second love of a guide dog. And that's chronicled in this chapter. I would close the discussion of this chapter by mentioning another aspect that I discuss, which is that when we first got the new boy in the house, he was very subdued. We would go out for a training. We would work. He'd be an excellent guide. He'd come home, and he'd curl up in a ball, and he'd just watch us. And I think he hadn't lived in the city before. We were two strangers in a house with two other dogs and three cats. And he was watchful. And I was worried. I was used to a dog that was ready to play, that would bring me anything from the house, drop it at my feet, and say, throw it to me. You know, I'll retrieve it. And he was just subdued and withdrawn. And I thought, we have to pep him up, do something to make him feel freer. Well, just as I was worrying about that, I think Tila was aware of it too. And I noticed, and we noticed, that she came along and she started trying to get him to play. She'd go up to him and raise her paw and bat at him, trying to get him to get down on the ground and play with her the way she played. She'd get down on the ground and put her elbows down, you know, and they'd do their haunches in the air, and she'd then reach up her arm and try to bring him down. And several times a day, she'd go up to him and she'd try to get him to play. She'd pick up toys and bring it to him so he would tug the toy. And she worked at it, and she worked at it. And a month later, they were playing every morning, first thing, when they woke up. She had succeeded, and he had started playing, and he had started happily greeting people in the house. And I had to learn that, whereas with Tila, from the beginning, I had to curb her wayward energy and her distractedness and calm her down. You saw how often maybe she got up every time I stood here. With him, I had to give him permission to be excited and happy and exuberant and not curb him. So very different, and it took a while, and it seemed to me that a new pair of eyes was also my new pair of eyes as I was learning how to move from one relationship to another and to accept that new relationship on its own terms. I would like to now turn the microphone again over to Anne to read you an excerpt from that last chapter that I think will give you perhaps even more a sense of this period of transition for us.
At night now, as I reach down next to our bed and touch Fresco, I finger his nylon collar, which helps me distinguish him from Tila. Good night, good guide, thank you, I say to him, and the words seem strange and new, as if I should not be saying these to any other dog than Tila. Tila comes into the room later. I hear the tinkling of her collar as she enters and gets onto her bed beside Fresco's, a small space dividing them. She lies down. I reach over to touch her, pat her soft fur. Thank you, good guide, girl. My tears are slow and gentle. For the moment, I have the company of these two. I will treasure this moment as long as I have it, as long as their two tongues lick me in the morning, their wet noses fresh from their night's sleep, letting me know they are ready for me, their person, their woman in need of a guide dog to get up and take them out. On Tila's neck, on her silver collar, I have left the tag that says guide dog, rather than substituting one that says retired guide that guide dog sent me over a year ago. I want Tila never to be retired, but to continue to lead the way for me, even as I follow Fresco. I look to her to help me with him, to help me know what might be possible, that the bond can grow, the depth of feeling be sustained, the learning be unexpected and enjoyed. As I walk with my new guide, I see less than I did when I walked with Tila, for my eyesight has diminished over time, although my life has not diminished but grown. As Fresco pulls me forward, guiding me in his way, prompt turns, a gliding motion to his step, showing me the importance of exploring while sniffing. As I follow this dog who curls into a ball when at home, his body so characteristically his own, as I learn to love him as I did Tila, I hope to be as deserving of his love, his loyalty, hers as well, as they take me not only along streets, but into a world of their pleasures. At Fresco's graduation ceremony, held on the guide dog's campus at the end of our training period, that afternoon out in the sun, the puppy raisers handed their dogs over to their new persons on a broad stage before families and friends. Hannah sat in the audience looking up proudly at Fresco and me. When it came our turn, I was led across the stage to stand beside the mother of the family who had raised Fresco, with whom he had been sitting. She took his leash and handed him to me, tearfully wishing us well. She and her husband each gave me a warm hug. She then read a statement by their high school-age daughter who was unable to attend. I once wondered what it would be like to be blind. Although as a little girl I tested this wonderment through the basic blindfold, I never truly experienced what it was like. Some may say that the God-given gift of sight is man's most important sense. But I, with my sight, beg to differ. It has been a definitive fact in every science textbook that there are five senses: taste, smell, sight, touch, and the ability to hear. Through the processes of raising guide dogs, I have discovered a sixth: love. The trust that a blind person has for their dog is remarkable. Not only do they trust this dog to not poop in the house, but also to be their eyes. These dogs cross streets, hop onto buses, and go everywhere else in between. I have a strong belief that love surpasses sight in every aspect, and that a guide dog is the epitome of love. Fresco, as you continue on your journey as a guide dog, I wish you the best of everything. The best belly rubs, the best walks, food, and potty breaks. Good job, Bubba. As I walk now with Fresco, the memories of Tila echoing in my mind, I cherish the spirit of those who raised him, the love that went into him, the journey we are on, a longer one than I ever expected. Tila is at home when I am out with Fresco, yet at other times I walk with her, using my white cane and a leash, or letting her roam free as we go. I play with her, throw her balls and frisbees to retrieve, our old habits sustaining us, the new ones evolving. And when I'm following Fresco, I often hear Tila in my mind talking to us. I said I would help you. Now, Fresco, remember. Every time. Remember to watch out for cars and curbs and holes in the ground where she might trip. Remember, she does not easily trust. Play with her. Retrieve a little. Make it a good life for her. I'm turning her over to you now. Keep your paws clean and your heart pure. Fresco, come walk beside me. Come, take her from me. And Fresco lifts his head and turns toward me. Come, he says. Come, let me guide you. Every time.
Thank you very much, Anna. Thank you so much. Excuse me for a moment. I'm going to settle the dog. Somewhere there's a microphone. Here it is. You could tell. I don't know if you could all see what just happened, but Fresco led the way. More dutiful, he went down first. Tila saw that he went down. She said, I guess dogs are supposed to go down after she went down. Thank you so much, Anne. This is what makes Anne such a good audiobook reader. She truly puts her heart into it, and I so have appreciated it. And that is the way the book ends, with the turning over of the leashes, so that I felt that Tila really did hand me over to him and tried as best she could to train him. This ends the formal part of my presentation. I think I would follow up with that George mentioned that on the table, in addition to some books, and Tila will sign some books, and she's on the cover with her paw. Her entire paw doesn't fit on the non-toxic ink pad, but the pads of the front and the middle pad, it's a pretty good imprint, so we can do that. I also have a few discs with the book in accessible PDF and Word format if you are blind or know anyone who is blind and would like to pick up a text copy. And we have a few copies of the last chapter from which Anne just read the conclusion, the last chapter of the audiobook, in case you know anyone or would be interested in the more full version there. I have a website if you go to susankrieger.stanford.edu, which has pictures of the dogs, more excerpts from the book, background, and some more audiobook samples. So I'd invite you to take a look at that and some more information about guide dogs and guide dog organizations in case you know anyone interested. I think the audiobook is available on Audible, and we worked hard at it, and Anne truly makes my words sound better than the original. I would like to also at this moment thank my partner, Estelle Friedman, who is Hannah in the book, because I changed the name of the persons but not the dogs. because I'm trying to honor the dogs by keeping their real names, and the person I'm trying to convey that even though I write personally and my intimates and other people figure in my stories to some extent, it really is my version of what may be a shared reality, and to some extent it's a fiction, though I try very hard to be truthful. And Estelle has led the way for the rest of us, often both emotionally and physically, helping us get through all the difficulties that we face. So I want to thank her publicly as well as privately. And I'd like to open it up to any questions you may have or any sharing of experiences. I know we have people in the audience who have some experience with blindness and with mobility and perhaps with dogs as well. So you may have something similar that you would like to share or some question, be happy to answer.
Great. And I'd like to remind our audiences that they're listening to Professor Susan Krieger of Stanford speaking about our book, Come, Let Me Guide You. And those of you who have questions, if you could come up here to the mic and ask them, and I'll start as someone's coming. The way you describe your dogs and the way you train them and their differences, it reminded me, as a professor, you must have to deal with your different students and their personalities about the same way. Which is easier?
Dogs.
Well, I've enjoyed your story very much, and I have a lot of empathy because about 10 years ago, I suffered a very serious bicycle accident. As you maybe watched me getting up here, my mobility is a real problem. And it's kept me from doing a lot of things I've really used to love to do. And just about a year ago, I got a rescue Labrador that has just changed my life. Interestingly enough, I have no idea where she came from, but she's probably the best trained dog I've ever had personal contact with, and she's just really opened up my life. And again, I want to thank you for your story because, again, I have a lot of similar feelings.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad you resonated. Thank you so much.
Next question. Would someone rather have me bring the mic to them? Okay, great.
I'm just really curious to know how Tila responded to the transition. I found it very interesting and wonderful to hear that she's still such a big part of your everyday life. But I wonder maybe if you have a sense from her perspective, especially at first when Fresco came home, how she kind of dealt with her new role for you.
Yes, that's a good question, as I discuss my response, and not so much hers. I think she's done okay. One of the things that I took special care with initially was that I arranged for someone to come and take her out for a walk every day as soon as we got the new boy, so that because it was, we have three dogs, and I would be half my day going for walks with all three, but also I wanted her to have another special relationship and that attention. So we did start that. I think that Tila was older by that time, and she needed her rest. She really was not able to get in and out of the car and do all those things strenuous for the dog. So I think she did appreciate that she wasn't being called to have to do many things that were hard for her to do. I think that she, these are on the positive side, I think that the greatest asset and boon to her was this playmate that she gained and him becoming so important to her. And I think that was the major positive for her. I'm sure that she missed me when I was out and out without her. And we tried to build in many things into our life so that Tila had varied days. She had dates with people, came and picked her up and played with her. And we really tried during that initial period especially to make sure that she had a lot of activity. So I think she did very well. I'm sure she misses me and misses me still and missed me during that time of the change. But I don't think it was traumatic for her. I think her great gain was him. I mean, it really was. Yeah.
I have a question. I was just, when I was a child, I would see assistance dogs, and they were very often German Shepherds. And it certainly seems like, as years have progressed, that they are considerably many more labs and retrievers, and I don't know, is that just my imagination, or is that something that is intentional, or do you know anything about the history?
Sure,
of that?
I'd be glad to. And can you tell me, I'm looking to my right here, is that a speaker or is that a person?
That's a speaker.
A speaker.
And the persons are back there.
Speaker,
okay,
straight
I'm dutifully looking at it. Non-existent. It suddenly occurred to me earlier. I mean, it doesn't make good radio, but I mean, anyway, wherever you are, persons, back straight ahead of me, persons. Yeah. Well, anyway, yes, you're correct. It used to be, and the conventional picture and the image that you have is of the German Shepherd, and I think they were the original dogs, but increasingly labs have become the dogs used for guide work. German Shepherds have more problems, more easily with their hips, and maybe a shorter working lifespan, though they're wonderful dogs. The labs, they can breed them, and they have a natural ability, very healthy, very athletic, and very good at taking command. And so you're right to see that change. And there are some golden retrievers. I think it's harder with the probability of getting a, in any litter, of having successful golden retrievers doing the guide work and the size of the litter and all the rest and health. It's a less high probability of the excellent health and obedience and training as the Labrador retriever, but they do cross them, and the Goldens are also good. And they do somewhat with poodles for the allergenic problems, but also I think the probability of really getting that good, disciplined, obedient poodle. Plus, there's something that the guide dog schools, I think, are concerned about, which is you have less grooming needs with the lab than you would with the poodle, where you have to manage the hair all the time. But they're very good for the job, and that's why the change.
Well, that was great. Thank you so much.
Sure.
Next question.
Thank you very much. I really enjoyed every word and every gesture. I had Labradors as a child into my 20s and love them dearly. And I'm about to say something which I hope comes out right. I have often thought that if I were blind, I wouldn't be able to see myself. I wouldn't be able to see my own reflection. So I want to tell you what you looked like when you were describing your dogs. There was such wonderful joy on your face and a smile and a joyfulness that touched me deeply. So I just wanted to reflect and tell you that.
Thank you. thank you very much.
Thank you very much. It was wonderful. And I was just wondering, I'm a former teacher, and you're always trying to get children to work together. How involved was Tila in the selection of your new dog?
That would be an interesting experience. She wasn't involved directly, let's say, because, Guide Dogs does select the dog for you, but they try to match your needs and your requirements. But I think that she was involved within me, obviously, in that I seem to have wanted another dog just like her. So I thought I was picking one just like her by his swift gait. You don't pick, but you're offered, and you have to see if it's a good match. His gait and his pace and his way of guiding and his alertness. He's a very bright dog and all the rest. And I think I was looking for her when I felt so glad to find him. And so she was kind of working through me in that way. But she really didn't have a direct say in it. But it's also true, just between you and me, that I did try out another guide dog before I got Fresco. And Tila did not like her.
Oh, good. Oh, so she did have a hand in it.
It was not a good match for me as well, but she didn't like her.
Good. Thank you.
The picking the dog reminded me of an iconic family story of ours. I'm one of 12 children, and when there were 11, the youngest one was 4 years old and had been used to being the baby, and when it was announced that there was another one, my parents, for the last 5 or 6 children, would have a family conference and choose a name for the next child. And it was back in the dark ages, you didn't have any idea whether it's a boy or a girl, so you'd pick a boy's name and a girl's name. So we had this meeting for the 12th child that was coming along, and the vote, I think, was loaded by my parents, but the vote was Barbara Joan if it was a girl, and Christopher Thomas if it was a boy. And the 11th child, the 4-year-old boy, raised his hand and said, "And Spot if it's a dog." And it was very clear what he wanted. So that was just wonderful. Is there one last question? We have time for one more question. Or I think would you like to tell us a little bit? I thought that one question was very interesting about not being able to see yourself. So I'll just give an example of something else about seeing yourself, not seeing yourself, that I think happens in old age to a lot of people. When people get Alzheimer's, they often don't recognize their spouse after a while. But if you show them pictures of their spouse when they were young, they say, "Yeah, that's my wife," or "That's my husband." Who is this older person that's living with me? But the younger person have. And I had an uncle who didn't get Alzheimer's, but he had in his room, after his wife died, after they'd been married for 60 years and had 10 kids, he had 30 pictures of his wife, and 27 of them were from when she was 23 or 24, and only a couple of them were from later on. And I was wondering if you feel that your image of your face stopped 10 or 15 years ago, or do you not know?
And this is addressed to me?
Yeah, I'm asking you.
I was put in mind when I was asked the question about, the person spoke about not seeing yourself. I do not see my face well. So I am a whole lot younger in my visual than I imagine I am. It's an odd feeling. The whole world is young to me, too. Because when I see people's faces, they're blurred. You don't see age. I've had to kind of teach myself to appreciate that there is an what the age is there, because I do not see it. In a way, you're freed of some of these biases of assessing people by age. If we have a couple of minutes, I can tell another dog story.
Yes.
Okay.
We certainly do.
Tila. So one of my favorite stories, I'm not sure that there is a moral or a lesson to it, but I think there are some people may appreciate it. So in addition to liking to retrieve Frisbees, Tila has always been fascinated by cats. And we have three of them, or we had, and she didn't pay much attention to our cats. But when we're out on the street, and if we were to come by any cat, she will always pull me toward the cat. And one of our first experiences when I had her was in San Francisco, up on the top of a hill in a residential area. And I stopped at a curb on the corner, and you know, she goes up the curb, and you gently stop and decide where you're proceeding there. And I must have not been holding the harness handle tightly, and she took off and ran and left me and ran down the hill. And I kind of went in search of her, and I found that she had run after a cat. Some big black cat was in front of someone's house and yowling, and she was facing it head on. And then I think the cat ran into the house, and my guide dog ran into the house right after the cat, and the door was open. And what do I do? You know, I ran into the house after the dog that was after the cat, and I can't see, and it was just dark, and I hoped that it was not a flight of stairs inside the door, and I was there, and the cat was howling. A baby was evidently in his house, and it started really shrieking, and I couldn't find my dog. I finally found my dog, grabbed it, pulled it out, got out of the house, out in the street. The people, I think, were unloading their groceries, and they were not very happy with me. Now, the self-justification that can occur at that time, I left there, and I thought, what's wrong with these people? You know, I got my dog out of your house. You just, you know, you justify anything. But from then on, I always have held her harness tightly and her leash, never letting them lapse too much, because I was from then on, and that was in very early years, afraid that this could happen again, because she did pull me to cats. And we were at the end of another block at one time, a dead-end street near where I live. And I had her off the leash, I think, because we may have been playing Frisbee. And I think a cat came, and she ran after the cat. And it puffed itself up big, and it hissed at her, and it put out its nails. And she went right close until it really did this big. And then she turned around and ran and got between my legs. And I thought, you know, it's... You learn about your relationship with the dog, that dog relies upon you for protection, just as you rely upon the dog. So he had this cat thing. So now when I walk with Fresco, I hold his leash very tight at every corner for fear he'll chase a cat, which he never has done, because he doesn't chase cats. But but she trained me. He wants to greet every dog we pass. And they're just different, and I have to weigh it each time. Do we greet and get him distracted, or is a little distraction good for my mild-mannered dog? So we figure it out, and it's a pleasure, you know, relating with their personalities, because, as I mentioned, I'm a very individual person, you know, primarily a writer, an internal person, and these dogs make me outgoing and bring me out and bring me in relation to people, because people, even that man on the plane, they're always talking to you because you have the dog. You have the cane. They don't walk by and say, what a beautiful cane. Though I wish they would. You know, I used to take pride in my cane. But people do talk to me, even if sometimes they say things that I don't want to hear, like, are you training that dog, assuming that I'm not blind because, you know, I don't show some stereotypical behaviors or something. But it puts me in contact with people, makes me outgoing, and that has been a big change in my life that I have appreciated. So I appreciate your coming and listening today, since, you know, I'm a writer and talking before people, and this book is very personally written. The bits that you heard today are only part of it. I have a lot of the internal discussion, because I think that's so important that we talk about the emotions that go on behind things. So you get a kind of internal view of what life is like with a guide dog, and also what life is like being a writer and a teacher and a partner and a person who doesn't see. You know, you get it kind of from the inside out. It's a very intimate book, and one of the most intimate, so I really appreciate you all coming to hear me speak of it, because it's a very good sharing that I'm privileged to do. Thank you.
We thank you very much for coming. So as we said before, the book is available for sale for anybody who would like it. And So ends another event at the Commonwealth Club, and it's 113th year of enlightened discussion. Thank you very much for coming.